This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, September 26, 2007. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Robert Lowell's breakthrough poem. Until his death in 1973, Robert Lowell was a father figure for many poets, including his former students Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath. Lowell and other confessional poets, as they became known, began using their autobiographies to explore subjects that had been taboo: mental illness, divorce, suicide. It hadn't been easy for Lowell to open up his private life for poetic scrutiny. On today's program, we're going to take a close look at Lowell's breakthrough poem, Skunk Hour. And for that purpose, I'm joined by Troy Jollymore from the studios of KCHO in Chico, California. Troy Jollymore is a poet, and he's also a professor of philosophy at California State University. He wrote a reading guide to Skunk Hour that you can read on our website, poetryfoundation.org. Hi, Troy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. In your reading guide, you say something that I had never heard before. Maybe it's common knowledge out there, but I had never heard it. You say that Lowell's poems changed in the late 1950s in reaction to Allen Ginsberg and the Beats. How so?
Well, Lowell did a tour around that time, the early 50s, really, at this point.
Uh-huh.
And he was reading in places that, especially San Francisco, that had been very much shaped by the sensibilities of the Beats. And so in particular, the audiences were responding in a certain way. And Lowell said that one of the things that happened as he went on with this tour was that he actually started to rewrite his poems, maybe not on paper, but in his head. He would actually read them differently. And he would change the rhythms of some of his poems and even add words in order to make it more clear, because he could tell that some of the meanings weren't getting across. They worked on the page, but they didn't work in the context of a live performance.
So Lowell's old poems, the ones that he wrote before he encountered the Beats and other folks in the 1950s, were very kind of rigorously formal, impersonal poems. Is that fair to describe them like that?
I think so, and extremely high-flown rhetoric and fairly bombastic poems. There was a fairly rigid idea of what poetry was, and some people reacted negatively to the early Lowell poems, and then certainly when he started writing poems like Skunk Hour, there were a lot of people who said, well, yeah, this is just sort of informal talking. It's not formal enough to be poetry.
So I actually have a recording of Robert Lowell reading Skunk Hour, but before we listen to it, I was hoping you could briefly set up the poem. What's this poem about?
Basically, it's a very simple sort of narrative story. We have four stanzas about a description of a town, followed by four stanzas in which the poet appears, wanders around, sort of spies on some people, and then observes some skunks swilling a garbage pail.
Okay, let's give it a listen.
Skunk Hour for Elizabeth Bishop. Nautilus Island's hermit heiress still lives through winter in her Spartan cottage. Her sheep still grazed above the sea. Her son's a bishop. Her farmer's first selectman in our village. She's in her dotage. Thirsting for the hierarchic privacy of Queen Victoria's century, she buys up all the eyesores facing her shore and lets them fall. The season's ill. We've lost our summer millionaire who seemed to leap from an LL Bean catalog. His nine-knot yawl was auctioned off to lobstermen. A red fox stain covers Blue Hill. And now our fairy decorator brightens his shop for fall. His fishnets filled with orange cork, orange his cobbler's bench and all. There is no money in his work. He'd rather marry. One dark night, my Tudor Ford climbed the hill skull. I watched for love cars. Lights turned down, they lay together hull to hull, where the graveyard shelves on the town. My mind's not right. A car radio bleats, love, oh careless love. I hear my ill spirit sob in each blood cell as if my hand were at its throat. I myself am hell. Nobody's here. Only skunks that search in the moonlight for a bite to eat. They march on their souls up Main Street. White stripes, moonstruck eyes, red fire under the chalk, dry and spire of the Trinitarian Church. I stand on top of our back steps and breathe the rich air. A mother skunk with her column of kittens swills the garbage pail. She jabs her wedge head in a cup of sour cream, drops her ostrich tail, and will not scare.
Robert Lowell reading Skunk Hour. That recording comes to us courtesy of The Poet's Voice, a series of CDs and books edited by J.D. McClatchy and published by Random House Audio. So, Troy, let's go through this poem, as you do in your reading guide. The first two stanzas are about a rich woman who lives on Nautilus Island, which I looked it up on Google Maps. It's off the coast of Maine.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And this character who is introduced in the very first line, Nautilus Island's hermit, Eris, who, as he writes, still lives through winter in her Spartan cottage, is one of two matriarchal images that really frame the poem. We have two stanzas about her, and then at the end come back to two stanzas about a very different sort of mother figure. And maybe the first thing that's worth noting is that when Lowell was working on this poem, his mother had fairly recently died. He had a very complex relationship with her.
Yeah, he came from a very wealthy Brahmin family in Boston, a very famous American family.
Yeah, New England aristocrats, more or less, that's right, and about which he always seemed to have conflicting feelings.
Mm-hmm. But you identified this Nautilus Island hermit old lady with Lowell's mother?
At least to a degree. I think both of the figures, the second one being the mother skunk, stand a bit for his mother, but maybe more importantly for potential models for him. He's at, as I argue, at a moment of crisis in his life.
Describe that crisis, actually.
Well, on the most straightforward sort of artistic level, he's been writing these, again, very heavily rhetorical poems. He feels that there's something falsifying about them, and he wants a poetry that is just more plain-spoken, more honest, but is very conflicted about this because it's hard for him to be intimate with details in such a public forum. It's hard for him to speak about the people that he knows and reveal these details to, you know, anybody that basically might pick up a book in which his poem appears.
Yet this poem doesn't do that. If it violates anybody's privacy, it's his own.
That's right. I mean, again, the way I read it is this poem is about his working through that process. The ones that come after it are more the ones that include the actual details of his family and so on. Here they do appear to some degree, but mostly on a metaphorical level. It's important, too, to understand Lowell that he suffered from mental illness. He had basically what was diagnosed at the time as manic depression. Mm-hmm. He would go through these very severe manic episodes and afterwards be institutionalized. And he often wrote in later years about the approach of one of these episodes. And one of the things that clearly is going on in this poem is that he seems to be approaching one of these manic episodes.
Yeah, there seems to be a crisis afoot. So, but let's go back to the old rich woman.
She's in her dotage, thirsting for the hierarchic privacy of Queen Victoria's century. She buys up all the eyesores facing her shore and lets them fall.
She's described as if it's the 19th century. There's no indication that anything, the 20th century is part of this poem yet.
That's right. And clearly that's the way she wants it. You know, if you look at that second stanza, she buys up all the eyesores facing her shore and lets them fall. Why? Because she's thirsting for this privacy, the hierarchic privacy. There's many allusions in the first parts of these poems about past ages and people who are essentially relics of the past, who just want things to stay the same and who aren't really wanting to face up to what life is like in the 20th century.
And then in the next two stanzas, he talks about some other characters on the island.
The season's ill. We've lost our summer millionaire who seemed to leap from an LL Bean catalog. His nine-knot yawl was auctioned off to lobstermen. A red fox stain covers Blue Hill. And now our fairy decorator brightens his shop for fall. His fishnets filled with orange cork. Orange is cobbler's bench and all. There is no money in his work. He'd rather marry.
Yeah, and these in some way for me have always been the most mysterious, but a number of things do come across. When John Berryman wrote about this poem, he pointed out that the decorator has taken fishnet, which of course is a very functional item, and made it a decorative item by turning it into orange cork.
Right.
And so in general, we have this worry in these two stanzas, really I think a worry in the first four, about simply being a useless item, which I think Lowell, again, is directing to himself, partly as a result of coming out of his class and his status, and partly worrying about his poetry and worrying what it was doing. What was his poetry actually doing in the world?
Right. Did it have an effect? Did it matter?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Now, I noticed that in your article, you didn't quote that one stanza with that mentions the fairy decorator. Is that because you think it's a slur?
That wasn't the main reason, although I've always worried about it. There's no question.
It is kind of a slur, right?
It is. And, yeah. You know, it was a different time, and we can forgive Lowell to an extent. But, no, there's no question that there is an uncomfortable attitude here that we won't be happy with.
Yeah. So up until this point, Lowell isn't really part of the poem. He's only indirectly part of the poem. We hear about our village and our fairy decorator.
Right.
And so we know that, you know, he lives there, but nothing more than that. And then he makes an entrance in the poem in a Ford Tudor.
One dark night, my Tudor Ford climbed the hill skull. I watched for love cars. Lights turned down, they lay together hull to hull, where the graveyard shelves on the town.
Even here, he introduces himself indirectly because, of course, the lines go, one dark night, my Tudor Ford climbed the hill skull.
Yeah, as if it's driving itself, right?
That's right. Yes, exactly. Something's going on, as if I'm just sort of watching or something like that.
Which is a nice way to suggest a kind of mental vacancy or trouble, that things are out of his control.
I think that's right. This is one of the things most likely he worried about, the tendency as an artist to have it remove you from the scene so that you can't be fully invested in it. But also, of course, there's a desire here perhaps simply to eschew responsibility for what's going on, because we soon find out what he is doing, which is he's there spying on young people who have come here in their cars essentially to make out.
Well, there is something kind of weird and perverted about him driving up and on top of a hill. And Robert Lowell at this time was a man in his 40s.
Right.
And there he is spying on young people necking in their cars.
Right.
Listening to pop music.
There's something very disturbing about the image. And it gets to the heart of this deep ambivalence that I think he was feeling at this time about his artistic vocation.
And then there's this line that drops into the poem suddenly and startlingly, and it's a very famous line. He says,
my mind's not right.
Doesn't that strike you as a total non sequitur?
It is, and I think that's what part of its power is. It does seem to come out of nowhere. And it is the first time as well he speaks of himself. Again, in the context of what we know about his mental illness, there is an obvious reading. I think there is also a second metaphorical reading along with that, that it's a working through of the issues that he has about being a poet, and this analogy between poetry essentially and being a voyeur, watching the world, invading people's privacy.
A car radio bleats, love, oh careless love. I hear my ill spirit sob in each blood cell as if my hand were at its throat. I myself am hell, nobody's here.
Now, I'd always read this poem as a sophisticated, elitist poet kind of going crazy at the vulgarity of American culture. reading your reading guide, I think I'm totally wrong now.
I'm not sure. I don't want to deny that reading. I think that's there too.
Yeah?
Yes, the vulgarity of American culture does come through. These lines about the lyrics, the car radio bleats, love, oh careless love. And I think there may be a part of him that's a bit threatened by the fact that these lines would be so much more popular and well-known than the lines that he's writing.
Yeah.
And of course, he's a very successful poet, so it's not that. But nonetheless, poetry's place in the culture is such that it's been marginalized.
It's enough to drive anybody to distraction.
It is.
And then come the skunks.
Yes.
And that's sort of mysterious, too, how the, first of all, skunks in general make an appearance, and then a particular mother skunk makes an appearance. What do you make of the skunks?
I think there's a lot to be made of them. The first thing, again, is to go back to the hermit heiress at the beginning. I said there were two matriarchal figures in this poem, and this seems to me the second. And in both cases, as matriarchal figures often do, I think that they provide the poet with a possible model, a way that he could live his life and pattern his existence. as an animal, the skunk is complex, of course. We have these obvious negative connotations to them for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But I also want to emphasize the alternative, that while he knows that he's not the skunk, he sees something attractive about that and sees that as a possibility for him perhaps. I mean, there is a lot of positive imagery in this last stanza that often gets ignored. Now, he starts off by saying, I stand on top.
Mm-hmm.
And then goes on to use the word rich, which, you know, while again complex, especially when you're speaking of smells and so on, is the first connotation we get from it generally is a positive connotation.
I myself am hell. Nobody's here. Only skunks that search in the moonlight for a bite to eat. They march on their souls up Main Street. White stripes, moonstruck eyes, red fire under the chalk. Dry and spire of the Trinitarian Church. I stand on top of our back steps and breathe the rich air. A mother skunk with her column of kittens swills the garbage pail. She jabs her wedge head in a cup of sour cream, drops her ostrich tail and will not scare.
I always found myself thinking that he was basically admiring of the skunks at the end. And yes, there was an ambivalence here, certainly.
Yeah. They are digging in trash.
Well, they are. That's right. And that's really the brilliance of the image as an image for what Lowell is doing. But on the one hand, it is positive and he feels his admiration. And yet, thinking about it, the more we picture it to ourselves, the more we realize that it's a disturbing, even disgusting image. You know, is this what Lowell is doing? A mother skunk with her column of kittens swills the garbage pail. Is that what Lowell is doing? Is that what his life is, swilling the garbage pail of humanity?
His life as a poet, you mean?
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that may be the appropriate role for poets in society because, you know, you can't pretend you're in an ivory tower, I think, if you're a poet.
Right. Though in a sense, I think Lowell worried that his early poems did do that. And
yeah.
They were very beautiful formal pieces, but they avoided the less attractive aspect. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that because when you look at something like Quaker Graveyard, it's full of violent, bloody imagery. So it's not the violence that he was avoiding, it was, I think, the triviality, the little details, you know, life as it's actually lived, was really what he was staying away from up to that point.
Troy Jollymore, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
You can read Troy Jollymore's Reading Guide to Skunk Hour on our website, poetryfoundation.org, where you can also find more than a dozen other reading guides, including one about Sylvia Plath's poem, Fever 103 Degrees. Do let us know what you think of this program, where our motto is...
You should never explain a poem, but it always helps, nevertheless.
Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. This program was edited by Owen Agnew, and the engineer at KHCO was Mike Birdsill. The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.